Good morning. Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The Second Division, the Honorable Justice Nathaniel House presiding, case number 24-0379, People of the State of Illinois, Richard Lindblom versus Best Buy Stores.
Good morning. My name is Nathaniel House. I'm a judge of the appellate court, and presiding over this case with me are Justices David Ellis and Rena Van Tine. This case is being heard via Zoom. Who are the attorneys representing the appellant? Please state your name.
Thank you, Your Honor. Paul Burks representing relators Richard and Ralph Lindblom.
All right, and who's representing the appellee?
Good morning, Your Honor. Michael McCutcheon on behalf of Best Buy Stores LP.
All right, we're going to proceed this way this morning. We're going to allow each side in turn to have 10 minutes of basically uninterrupted presentation. At the end of that presentation, the judges will have an opportunity to ask questions if they have any. After that, the appellee will be allowed to present its 10 minutes, and the appellant will be allowed to make a short rebuttal, after which the judges will be asking questions. At that time, we'll try to give you a 2 minute heads up that your time is running out. Do you have any questions about how we're going to proceed today?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Very well then, Mr. Burks, you may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Paul Burks, and I represent the relators Richard and Ralph Lindblom. The Lindblom brothers ran an appliance store in Schaumburg, Illinois, for their entire adult lives. And before them, their father ran that same store. So that store, Advanced Appliances, was in Schaumburg for 50 years. And defendant Best Buy is the largest electronics retailer in the United States. And it sells, as we all know, and installs TVs and speaker systems, computers. But it also sells and installs dishwashers and microwaves. So that is where their businesses and my client's business overlap. Best Buy undersold my clients and the other independents, what are referred to as the independent appliance retailer stores in Illinois, by not charging tax on these certain installed appliances. And Best Buy's position was it didn't owe the tax because while it was an electronics retailer most of the time, it was a construction contractor when it sold and installed dishwashers and microwaves. And this theory could not be reconciled with the plain language of the retailer's occupation tax or the relevant regulations or common sense. But the scheme did work for a while, and Best Buy was able to maintain parity with the other multi-state retailers by taking this aggressive tax position in Illinois and using their well-staffed, well-funded tax compliance departments to find these types of opportunities for tax savings. The Lindbloms didn't have this. They had a store, they had an accountant who read the tax regulations, they followed the rule, and they paid the tax, and they suffered. They suffered lost sales. They suffered a competitive disadvantage. And the state and the local government suffered lost tax revenue. And then, thanks to the Lindblom's, in 2015, the Department of Revenue caught on. It issued a compliance alert instructing the retailers that sell appliances to collect sales tax. And that compliance alert was issued in June of 2015. And what did Best Buy do? They did not start collecting and remitting tax in Illinois until 2020 or 21. And if a fact finder gets a chance to look at the evidence, we think it will conclude that the reason Best Buy did not follow the law was because doing so would have put it at a competitive disadvantage against their main competitors, the Lowe's and the Home Depots and the other multi-state retailers. They would have been in the same boat as the Lindblom's and the other Illinois-based independent retailers. And the Lindblom's sued Best Buy under the Illinois False Claims Act. Judge Curry on the circuit court granted to Best Buy summary judgment. We think this court should reverse and remand for trial. The court granted summary judgment on three grounds. I'd like to start with the issue of scienter, whether Best Buy acted knowingly. And in light of the Lowe's decision, I think it makes sense to break down that scienter question into a pre-compliance alert and a post-compliance alert period. And for the post-compliance alert period, Best Buy is just like Lowe's. Best Buy received the compliance alert, just like Lowe's. Best Buy did not change its practice in light of the compliance alert. It continued to employ the same tax practices it employed prior to the alert, which was not to charge tax, not to collect tax, not to remit the tax on the installed dishwashers and microwaves. It continued to do that for a full 5 years after getting direct information from the department that it was wrong. In fact, it went back to the department. hand in hand with its supposed competitors and asked the department to change its position from the compliance alert, and it received in November 2016 another letter from the department reaffirming the position that they took in the compliance alert, and Best Buy still didn't change its practice. It could have changed its practice and contested the department's position. It chose not to do that. And the question is why? Knowing what the law was, why doesn't Best Buy comply? That, Your Honors, is a fact question. A fact finder should look at the documentary evidence, assess the credibility of the witnesses, and decide if Best Buy's purported reasons for failing to pay the sales tax in light of the compliance alert, in light of the 2016 letter, were knowingly false or revealed a failure to exercise prudent judgment. Based on the evidence in the record, a fact finder could conclude that Best Buy did not change its practice because it was concerned about the competitive consequences of compliance. It was not concerned about the accuracy of its returns, and that is a knowing violation. So what is the evidence in the record on which a fact finder could reach that conclusion? Let's look at, if you look in the record at 3821 and 3862, you have emails from Best Buy the day after the compliance alert comes out to its supposed competitors, Lowe's and Home Depot, and it asks them, what is the impact on Lowe's and Home Depot of this compliance alert? And it goes on to say, we want to know because we want to, quote, see if Best Buy will be taking a consistent approach with Lowe's, assuming we make a change to begin charging sales tax to customers at point of sale. So you have Best Buy saying to its supposed competitors, we see the compliance alert, we need to change our practice, but we're not going to do it unless you do it. Lowe's and Home Depot respond, we're not changing our practices. And then at 3874 in the record, you will see an email internal to Best Buy where they say, we've spoken with Lowe's, we've spoken with Home Depot, our competitors aren't making changes, so we are not making any changes to our current processes. And we think that a fact finder looks at that evidence, they will see the motivation of Best Buy. They will see that they knew what the law required of them, and they didn't do it because of the competitive disadvantage it would put them at. And what does the record also not reveal? It doesn't reveal in the post-compliance alert period any correspondence, any analysis, any attempt by Best Buy to go back into the regulation, to go back into the law to say, are we doing this right? To analyze whether the compliance alert and the subsequent letter had corrected a misimpression. They don't do that. In fact, on July 1, 2 weeks after the emails I just described to you, we have an internal email within Best Buy where their internal compliance people ask, quote, do we have any contractor licenses? So this is in July of 2015. They have been claiming to be a construction contractor for the entire damages period. And in July of 2000, for the first time, they're asking, do we have any contractor licenses in Illinois? And the answer is no. But you don't see any attempt to make that analysis. So if they're not making a good faith effort to determine their liability, and they know what the compliance alert requires, and they're not following it because of the competitive disadvantage, that's a knowing violation. And we think that a fact finder should be allowed to see that evidence and make that determination for the post-compliance alert period. Turning to the pre-compliance alert period, in the Lowe's decision, the court found that Lowe's did not knowingly avoid the tax in the pre-compliance alert period, and it pointed to two factors, the audit of Lowe's and Lowe's good faith investigation efforts. And on both of those grounds, Best Buy is different than Lowe's. And so the outcome should be different. This case should go to trial on that period as well. First, with respect to the audit, the court was careful in the Lowe's decision not to immunize every taxpayer that was audited from False Claims Act, False Claims Act cases. Thank you, Your Honor. The immunity position was actually raised in the Lowe's case. And in footnote 3, the court recognized that an audit does not immunize a taxpayer from a False Claims Act case. And it identified instead four factors that must be present in the audit for the taxpayer to be able to rely on it. It has to be the audit has to cover the same period of the case. The taxpayer has to submit data to the department that specifically includes entries concerning tax treatment of installed dishwashers and microwaves. The data has to be scrutinized by the auditors, and the department has to fail to assess. Then the taxpayer can rely on that audit. That's paragraph 59 of the Lowe's decision. The evidence here, in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, reveals that the Illinois Department of Revenue conducted two audits, one of them for a period preceding the damages period here. The auditors did not scrutinize the data. In fact, Best Buy admits that the issue was never raised in their audits. The auditors did not discover Best Buy's practice. And when they went back to follow up and did look at the data, they assessed Best Buy. So you have a very different factual situation here, because the facts show that Best Buy did not submit the same data that Lowe's submitted in the audit. And the facts show that the auditors clearly did not look at it. In fact, there's admissions by Best Buy to that effect that we've cited on page 38 of our opening brief and page 9 of our reply brief. And there's also the test. There's also documentary evidence showing that the auditors did not look at this issue preceding the appliance audit in 2015. So for that pre-compliance alert period, the audit is very different. And secondarily, for the pre-compliance alert period, the investigation is very different, because what you have in Best Buy is you have these assumptions, and they're prevalent throughout Best Buy's analysis of the construction contractor exemption. You see these assumptions that we're a construction contractor, assumptions that were permanently installed. So they essentially assume the result. And when they were told they were wrong in the compliance alert, they never went back to look at it again. So these facts distinguish this case from Lowe's and suggest that this case should go back and be tried to a fact finder on the question of scienter. There are several other issues in the appeal, but I realize that my opening 10 minutes has reached its conclusion.
Thank you. Justice Ellis, do you have any questions?
Thank you, Justice House. Can you hear me, counsel?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Burks. Thank you for your presentation. Good morning.
Good morning.
Just a couple questions. The pre-compliance letter periods. So you have argued that the four factors, I think you referred to it as, mm-hmm. from Lowe's, are not met here, but even if that's true, is there any affirmative evidence that you've put into the record that, in fact, that does establish the scienter requirement? I mean, as the non-movement on summary judgment, if this is the sort of a summary judgment argument where the defendant says there's no proof, then you have an obligation, don't you, to put forward something?
Right. Yes, Your Honor. But the standard here for knowingly is recklessness. Is did they fail to inquire? Did they fail to make prudent inquiry? Did they fail to analyze information that was available to them? So when we say that the evidence in the record shows that they failed to do that, we're looking at the analysis that they did. I think in the MyPillow case, the court says, look, you know, whether somebody acted recklessly depends on what they did to figure it out. So when we look at what they did to figure it out, we think it shows there's enough evidence that a fact finder could show that it was reckless because of the assumptions that they went into it with, because of the failure to re-examine in light of the compliance alert, because of the failure to disclose overtly, knowing that the department was looking at the issue. And I would sort of suggest
how they reacted to the compliance letter is after 2015, right? I'm talking
sure.
about before the compliance letter. Am I hearing you basically say that the absence of proof is proof of absence? Is that really what you're saying here?
I would not put it that way. What I would say is I would put it as garbage in, garbage out. I would say that if you have a compliance department whose goal might be to find tax savings, to take aggressive tax positions. Because for a large multi-state retailer like Best Buy, tax savings across the board is real money. So if you are designed to take aggressive tax positions, and so you tell your consultants or you tell your tax compliance people, hey, look, you know, we've got to compete with Home Depot. We've got to, now I don't have, I'm not saying that these are quotes or anything. I'm not saying there's evidence in the record of anyone saying this. I'm saying that if you look at the evidence, you can see an outcome-driven analysis in order to maintain a competitive parity with their competitors.
Okay, but I think you understand my point here. I mean, they're coming in, Best Buy is coming in saying you have to prove it, and there's nothing in the record. And I'm hearing you talk about what happened after 2015, and obviously we're talking about the pre-compliance letter time. Garbage in, garbage out. Okay, recklessness is we did something reckless. Are you just saying the fact that they took the position at all was proof of scienter?
I think it is some evidence of scienter, because if you look at the regulation, I don't think that a common sense, reasonable, I think most people are like Rich Lindblom. If they look at the regulation, they say, does somebody who installs a dishwasher, and our tax laws are supposed to be common sense tax laws. You're supposed to look at them. That's in the Hartney case. They should be consistent with common sense. So I think it is some evidence that they went and looked at this regulation and said, you know what, dishwashers and microwaves, we might be contractors when we did that. That's part of it. And then the second part of it is the analysis, the absence of the analysis, the absence of any really, and the conclusions that they drew, the single that a sales receipt is a construction contract if it has installation and the sale on the same receipt, that becomes a
But that's all
construction.
kind of one thing, right? You're saying that the position that they took was itself reckless. But do you
I
have, besides that, is there anything in the record that suggests that they, for example, didn't provide everything to the auditor? Or they said, boy, we really got away with one there, didn't we? Now, I know that's a little too on the nose, but anything of that nature that would suggest we know we might be wrong, but no one's catching us. Something along those lines, anything like that?
There's not affirmative evidence along those lines, but I would say that I would refer you back to the legal standard, which is the failure to make prudent inquiry and inquire further when information is in front of you. So burying your head in the sand and not saying anything is also a knowing violation.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, counsel.
Ms. Van Tine, do you have any questions?
So, focusing again on that pre-compliance alert period, before that was issued, didn't the Illinois Department of Revenue allow retailers to rely on that contractor exemption and just collected the use tax? And didn't Angela Freitag say as much in her deposition? So, and how, and do you see that as relevant at all to the Sientar pre-compliance alert period?
So I would say that if you look, the evidence is disputed on whether the department permitted the type of behavior that Best Buy engaged in this case. And I would say that that a fact finder is likely to find that they did not, because the testimony of Geralyn Gordon, who was the chief tax compliance officer or lawyer at the Department of Revenue for 30 years, is fairly clear that she understood, and the department's position was that these sales were retail sales. Now, the testimony of Ms. Freitag is disputed. I mean, it's disputed by herself, where she testifies to different things from different leading questions. But I would say that in the record itself, the testimony of Ms. Gordon creates at the least a disputed question of fact. But in fact, the department's position has been consistent that these sellers are retailers. They are not construction contractors.
Even before
Even before the compli even before the
then what,
compliance
why
alert.
didn't the department collect the tax? It says that
So
now, after the pre-compliance period was owed.
With these multi-state retailers, these are enormous audits. And this is truly the tail wagging the dog for a multi-million-dollar retailer like Best Buy that sells so many products. And we did have testimony. I want to make sure that I'm not misrepresenting the record, but that auditors don't look at every issue in every audit. They just don't have the time. They don't have the resources. They identify issues and then they look at them. And for something like this, which obviously, it affects Richard Lindblom and Bud Lindblom a lot, but the amount of money at issue for the state is not that significant. So the auditors So it was only the independents who followed the law because the risk of an audit to them was great. But for the for these multi-state retailers, they found an opportunity. And the auditors, you know, I'm not saying that no auditor ever looked at it, but in the two audits of Best Buy, which are in the record, we know that the auditors did not look at the issue because there's no evidence in the record that they did. And there's in fact the documentary evidence from the auditor for the 2011 through 2013 period saying, "Hey, my boss told me to come back and look at this issue, which I didn't look at in the last audit." So auditors don't look at everything. This was not an issue that was on the department's radar until Richard and Bud Lindblom brought it to them. And then they began to investigate it and found non-compliance. And in fact, the department looked at the regulation in 2015 and they said, "We don't need to change the regulation. The regulation's clear. There's just non-compliance going out there." And that was Ms. Gordon's testimony. She worked on the compliance alert and she was the chief sales tax lawyer there for 30 years. And she said, "Yeah, I was asked to review the regulation and see if it needed to be updated. And I looked at it, we looked at it. It didn't need to be updated. We just needed compliance."
And backing up a bit, can you explain to me what is it that makes, what exactly is a construction contractor? What is it about the contract that makes it a construction contract or not?
Okay, I mean, I think that this court's decision in the Best Buy case, the tax Best Buy case, was really good on this in the sense that, look, a construction contractor is someone who holds themselves out as providing the service of construction. And then in the course of doing that, I'm going to build you a house, they have to incorporate materials into that. So if you think of it from just that paradigmatic example of someone who comes to you and says, I'm gonna build you a house, I'm gonna add an addition for you." And then you say, "Okay, what do you need to do that?" And those materials become incorporated into the addition. That's a construction contractor. If you walk into a store and say, "I'd like to purchase that item over the counter, and can you install it?" That's a retailer. And I think it is a common sense distinction, which Rich and Bud Lindblom and the other independent retailers were fully aware of. Rich would never say he was a construction contractor, even though he's installed thousands of dishwashers.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Burks, although the language of the regulation didn't change for previous to 2015, doesn't the fact that a compliance alert was necessary at all indicate that there was some question or gray area about how this was to be handled? The fact that they had the issue, you know, she looked at it and said, "Well, I see what the language is, but there's some question about how we interpret this. Therefore, we're going to let everybody know this is how it should be interpreted." Therefore, going to the pre-compliance period.
I think
Is
that
there scienter?
no, I think that sort of infers too much. I think what the department said is that we have found a problem, which is to say that it's prevalent in this industry that people are not following the law. Why it's prevalent in this industry, we've looked at the regulation, we think we've been consistent, we think we've been clear, but taxpayers have come to us and they said, our competitors, the playing field isn't level because certain competitors, all of them multi-state, you know, big box retailers are doing it different than all of these local independents are doing it. And so we have non-compliance. Now, we could address this in multiple ways. They have a lot of tools in their tool bag, right? We could go audit each one of them individually and focus on this particular issue. But that's not a huge revenue source for the Department of Revenue. So let's do this in a broad, across the board way and tell all of these folks a shot across the bow from here on out, do it this way and solve the problem that way. But that it doesn't imply or suggest that anybody had any that they necessarily had a good faith reason for doing it wrong, other than that it was to their economic advantage to do it wrong and they thought they could get away with it.
But thank you. I have no further questions. Any further questions, Justice Ellis, Justice Van Tine?
Nope.
Okay.
No, thank you.
Okay. All right. Very well then. Thank you. Ms. McCutcheon, you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court. I want to touch on a couple issues that were raised in the questioning first before I get into my general presentation. First, as to Justices Van Tine's point, yes, there were several GILs and PLRs that were generated by the Department of Revenue over the years that specifically stated that a retailer could act as a contractor when installing dishwashers and over-the-range microwaves. You can find them at C1772, which was written by Ms. Gordon, who admitted during her deposition that this issue had always been consistently confusing to taxpayers in Illinois. And in fact, there's plenty of evidence in the record that it was confusing within the department itself, which is what led to the 2015 compliance alert, as Justice House has aptly recognized. That particular PLR, just Ms. Gordon states that the taxpayer must physically incorporate into Realty a microwave, and it must meet two tests. The microwave must be physically incorporated into the real estate, permanently attached to the real estate, and that it's bolted to the cabinetry, and that it must be hardwired. That's exactly what was happening here, and that's exactly the type of guidance that Best Buy was following. The record is replete with evidence that Best Buy had a routinized process for reviewing Illinois law, and in fact, the law of all 50 states on this issue of installed appliances. It is an entire misstatement of the record to say that the presumptions that were included in KPMG's separate analysis, which agreed with Best Buy's internal analysis, was set up with false premises. There's no evidence of that. In fact, the evidence in the case shows that it was KPMG that put in those presumptions. So the court can put that aside. The trial court here at page 15 of its opinion recounted in great detail and throughout its 40-page well-reasoned opinion that Best Buy analyzed this issue both before the compliance alert in a routinized manner using the best software and the best people available, that it used outside consultants in KPMG and otherwise to look at it as well, and that advice confirmed what Best Buy had arrived at internally, and that after the compliance alert was issued, Best Buy looked at it again. Again, Ms. Yonke's testimony, and I encourage you to look carefully at Ms. Yonke and Ms. Nolan's testimony in this case. It is clear that they looked at this and arrived at the conclusions they did. Post a client alert, what did Best Buy do? Best Buy looked at it again. Again, at page 15, you'll see this, and throughout the opinion of the circuit court, and decided that it disagreed with the Department of Revenue's new position, which was in fact a new position as the circuit court arrived at. So they paid the ROT under protest, okay? Unlike Lowe's, we're not like Lowe's at all. They paid that money under protest and initiated a Protest Monies Act action, which is its fundamental statutory right under Illinois law. And it prosecuted that case all the way to the end until it got to the Supreme Court and was denied review. Although it lost the case and was ultimately found to have made a mistake is not a basis for a False Claims Act case. There has to be fraud, there has to be reckless conduct, there has to be a head-in-the-sand approach. Certainly, litigating a case as far as it could possibly go within the state of Illinois is not a head-in-the-sand approach to dealing with this issue. The case law that relators rely upon repeatedly to try to establish that Best Buy was reckless is the case law that Best Buy created itself by litigating the issue. In fact, prior to that, there was none. None. All there was information that could be gleaned from the PLRs and the GILs. So, under both Relax the Back, which this court issued years ago, and under, excuse me, National Business Furniture, this case falls squarely within that context in which you have a gray area of the law, which Best Buy undertook a limited duty to review, although they reviewed it extensively with the help of outside counsel, and arrived simply at the wrong decision. That is not fraud. But thankfully, the court doesn't have to wade into any of the scienter issues that we have here, because there's two other issues that are controlling and dispositive of the case. The most simplest way to get to dispose of the case here is really on the pre suit mandatory requirements of IFCA. Under those requirements, the plaintiff is required to submit the complaint that he puts together under seal to the state of Illinois and submit a statement of material facts that lays out all the information that relator knows about, in this case, Best Buy. Relators undisputably did neither in this case. They try to say that it should relate back to the original filing, but there is nothing the same about Best Buy's case in the cases of Sears, Lowe's, and Home Depot, such that it could possibly be considered the same sort of case or related to the same, fundamental fraud. In fact, it's an entirely new defendant with entirely new facts, time periods, auditors that were involved, products that were involved. There simply is no continuity between those. And so the Supreme Court of the United States has held that it is within the sound discretion of the trial court to issue a sanction of dismissal in cases in which the relator fails to follow these pre-suit requirements. Again, there's no dispute that they failed to do so. The Judge Curry in this case dismissed the relator's case at the outset of his opinion as a sanction based on their failure to comply with the pre-suit requirements. That is reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard. And under an abuse of discretion standard, this court has to decide that no reasonable person could have arrived at that particular conclusion. Best Buy submits that there's no way that this panel, Your Honors, could arrive at that conclusion. It should be upheld. There's mixed case law on this issue in the federal courts as to whether or not a case should or shouldn't be dismissed as a result of a violation. But the fact that there's mixed case law doesn't mean that Judge Curry got it wrong or that no reasonable person could have arrived at that decision. In fact, it's the opposite. Other courts have. And in this situation, you have all of the Lujan factors that my opponent says that the court didn't pay attention to. And what's the most important? It's harm to the government. The government was robbed of its opportunity to investigate and review these claims, which were, by the way, under specific audit as the Best Buy. That is quite different than Lowe's. It's quite different from Home Depot, which are also sued. It was under specific audit, and had it been given the chance to do that investigation, it would have realized that, but it was robbed of that opportunity. That is the harm to the government in this case. But what's more important is the bad faith. This cannot be lost on the court when it comes to this issue. When plaintiffs filed their amended complaint that added Best Buy for the very first time to this case, they fundamentally misrepresented that they had filed those procedural requirements. And you can find that misrepresentation at C-1753 to 1754. The plaintiffs have firmly stated that they had done that. That was untrue.
Minutes.
Moving on, as to the public disclosure bar, this court has approved of the Seventh Circuit's approach to what is a public disclosure in terms of having disclosed the fraud to the government entities that are in charge of reviewing the issue at hand. In this case, the Department of Revenue. There is no question and is undisputed that Best Buy repeatedly disclosed its tax practices with regard to installed appliances to IDOR in 2009, in 2014, and again in 2015. The relators didn't sue based on zero information, which they admitted under oath they had zero information about Best Buy when they sued. They didn't sue until 2016, many, many months before all of this was disclosed. There's no doubt that that audit and that investigation that the IDOR undertook was a public disclosure under Seventh Circuit authority. And I would remind this court, and in particular, Justice House, you wrote an opinion years ago in a case known, Musateri versus People's Gas. And in that case, you wrote favorably about the Glasser standard, which is, again, in the Seventh Circuit, if there is a disclosure to the government that is in charge of investigating these claims, and the government is in fact investigating these claims, that is a public disclosure. Again, this court cited Glaser and its progeny again favorably in another case. later on, which was a Rule 23 order. It is clear from the jurisprudence in the first First District that they look to the Seventh Circuit in trying to decide these issues, right? And the Seventh Circuit has continually held that where there is a disclosure, whether confidential or not, to the government entity that's in charge of the investigation and it is actively investigating it, that qualifies as a public disclosure. So there was a public disclosure, contrary to what my opponent insists. And importantly, they do not challenge on appeal that they do not qualify as an original source of the fraud. That argument has been waived. So if this court decides that a tax audit is a public disclosure, and by the way, all tax audits are confidential. This legislature is presumed to know that when it writes its statutes, and it included audit and investigation in the statute specifically. And when it did so, it must know that tax claims, which are subject to False Claims Act actions in Illinois, are all confidential. So it makes sense that they could be a public disclosure in Illinois. To hold otherwise, Your Honors, would write that write audits and investigations out of the statute in any case that involves taxes. And this state is filled with cases of False Claims Act cases related to taxes, as you well know. It's in the minority. There's only nine states in the union that allow it. And importantly, the federal courts don't allow it. So when you see these federal cases that my opponent cites to, let's say that a confidential tax audit cannot be a public disclosure, they're inapposite because that issue doesn't come up in the federal courts. And in those cases, they basically say disclosure alone to the government isn't enough. And I agree with that. And so does the Seventh Circuit. But it's not the case here. The case here is there was an active investigation and an active audit of Best Buy at the time. So you should find in favor first on the procedural failings at the outset. That's easy. That's an abuse of discretion standard. Two, you can find in Best Buy's favor on the issue of public disclosure. Again, I posit that's the issue has already been decided by this court. And third, the scienter issue doesn't get off the ground. We've already talked about that at length. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you. Justice Ellis?
Thank you, Justice House.
You have any questions? I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, you're fine. I just have a couple questions. Thank you, Mr. McCutcheon, and good morning. Want to take you back to the time of the compliance letter. You said, I believe, just talking now, you said we paid the Best Buy, that is, paid the penalty, the tax under protest, and then sued. But am I correct that it was only after the state initiated another audit against you that this even came to pass? There was the compliance letter in June, but didn't they undertake a special audit in, I think, August, or maybe it was September of 2015?
Your Honor, so there was an audit that was ongoing prior to the issuance of the compliance alert, in which Best Buy's treatment, like it had been for years, of these products was disclosed to the Department of Revenue. It got a clean audit on that issue there, but then the department asked subsequently to the close of that audit in early 2015, what is happening with these installed appliances? Can you clarify how you treat it? And Best Buy was honest. It said we take the position that we're acting as a contractor and that use tax is applied, not ROT. So that investigation began in May of 2015 before the compliance alert issued. The formal special audit was initiated, you're correct, Your Honor, in August. And a memo was provided to Best Buy by the IDOR in October of 2015, stating that its conclusion was it was taxing incorrectly. And from that point forward, the issue went through the appeals process within the Department of Revenue, and Best Buy lost in the appeals process. And it was after that, in early 2016, again, before the relators sued, that they initiated the Protest Monies Act case. And it, by that time, had hired my law firm to represent it in that proceeding to flesh out what is the truth here? What does the law really require? Because again, there was no binding guidance from this court or any other as to how these products should be treated, either use tax or ROT. Best Buy established that in the law for the first time, and that wasn't set in law until 2020.
Okay. On the question of the public information bar, it has different terms, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So I think you even acknowledge the weight of federal authority is that mere confidential disclosure to the government does not, maybe not in the Seventh Circuit, but outside the Seventh Circuit, many courts have said that mere confidential disclosure to the government is not public. And I think their reasoning has been, when if it's beyond that, if it's beyond confidential information, if it's out there and known to people, then you're really not blowing any whistle because it's already been blown. But as long as it's not known publicly beyond some confidential government, you still want to be incentivizing people to find these problems and perhaps even nudging the government that might sometimes drag its feet. I'd like you to address that, and I guess I have a second question. Did I hear you say your principal distinction between those cases, which is really just the Federal False Claims Act versus the Illinois version, is a linguistic one, that the Federal False Claim Act does not mention audits, whereas the False Claims Act in Illinois does? Did I hear you say that?
No, let me start with that question first.
Okay, I'm sorry. I asked you two questions at the same time. I try not to do that, but.
So no, the federal act does include audits and investigations by the government. The distinction is under federal law, you cannot bring a tax False Claims Act case. That has to be dealt with through the tax courts. So the federal courts don't deal with confidential audits in the tax context whatsoever. The difference is Illinois courts do. And the legislature is presumed to know that tax cases are subject to Illinois False Claims Act cases. And because of that, when they wrote the statute, it necessarily means that audits and investigations in the tax context, which are always confidential, must qualify as public disclosures. To answer your first question, to hold otherwise writes the language right out of the statute as it applies to tax cases. And that's not fair. I mean, some defendants can rely on audits, but the people that are accused of tax violations cannot. That can't be the law. I think to answer the first question, I think was about those federal cases
Yeah, sort of the general reasoning behind them.
The general reasoning behind them, I think, is sound, and the Seventh Circuit has acknowledged that some of that general reasoning is sound. But the distinction there again is. The Seventh Circuit is holding on this is nuanced, and it's nuanced in a way that makes sense in Illinois. If there's a general disclosure of information to the government, that does not qualify as a public disclosure. I'll agree with you on that, confidential or not. That's why the government disclosure bar was written out of the statute, and now the public disclosure bar applies. So the idea that we're asking for a reinstatement of the government's disclosure bar is a non-starter. We're not. The distinction in the Seventh Circuit, and it's a smart one, is that a disclosure isn't enough. It has to be to the management of the government, in this case, IDOR, which is responsible for reviewing the exact type of fraud that's at issue here. And IDOR does review Best Buy's audits and information and tax treatment for fraud and negligence over and over again in every tax period that it submits. And I would remind you, never found any negligence or fraud whatsoever. But the distinction is that managerial body has the information, and the Seventh Circuit has said public means disclosed within the act, and the government that's charged with it is acting for the public at large. And if it's aware of the fraud, then there's no reason to reward a whistleblower with a 30% bounty for bringing in information that's redundant. But the key thing and the difference, I think, between those other cases in the Seventh Circuit is that it takes a step further, saying just disclosure alone isn't enough, but an active investigation, right, which is what we have here in the audit, an active investigation that discloses it is sufficient to qualify as a public disclosure. And that makes sense under Illinois law.
Okay.
But again, I would remind you don't have to go that far. You can look at the pre-filing neglect and the pre-filing, misrepresentations to decide this case on an abuse of discretion standard.
Well, so on that point, and then I will be done, I promise. But so in the cases where an amendment to the QI-TAM action adds new claims, you will see times where the courts will say, yeah, we, you have to go back through the ceiling. But talk about, so here, a new defendant was unquestionably added. And when you add a new defendant, of course, there's different facts. Of course, it's a different story. It's, there might even be different time periods. But the general theory, the arguments, the claims were really identical to Sears and the others, weren't they? I mean, it was the exact same thing. It's you're selling these things at retail, but then installing them and calling yourselves a contractor. I mean, or do you disagree with that?
Well, I disagree in the sense that the theory of liability pertains to taxation of installed appliances. These entities are separate entities. In fact, they're competitors. They
Sure.
act differently. They have different internal employees. There's different auditors involved in how they when they're in front of the Department
But
of
it's the same question, right? They're answering. I mean, yes, of course, there's differences, different company, different people, maybe different time periods, but it's the exact same controversy, right?
It is. Yes, the same idea. But if you take a look at the cases that deal with this, and again, I think they're consistent when it comes down to it, and looking at when there's new defendants added to a case, you have to go back through the process. And if you don't, the dismissal on an abuse of discretion standard is appropriate. And the reason for that is, think about this. The relators unquestionably would have had to go through this process of filing under seal and providing the government with a statement of material facts if they had filed a new lawsuit against Best Buy, which is what they should have done. They didn't do that. And I would posit that the reason they didn't do that is because they admitted, in this case, under oath, that they had no information about Best Buy. They admitted repeatedly that they didn't know anything about Best Buy until January of 2016, when they had sued the others back in 2015. And even that was speculation. So they couldn't provide the government with a statement of material facts. And they undermined the entire system, I posit intentionally, in order to get to that bounty. You can't allow plaintiffs to smuggle claims past the government, and to hold otherwise in this case would be what you would be the effect of that. If you can file one complaint that has general allegations of fraud against, defendants one, two, and three, and the government looks at it and decides not to intervene for whatever reason, a claimant could then go out and smuggle in more viable claims, more interesting claims against other defendants, and still enjoy that 30% bounty, and rob the government of the opportunity to review it and take those cases itself, in
Well,
which case.
it wouldn't permanently rob the government, would it? I mean, the government could still intervene in the case, yeah.
It theoretically could intervene in the case, but it would have to make a good cause showing for the reason why. Prior, and the reason that the statute is set up the way it is to allow it to do a full investigation. And let's just stick to the facts of this case. I'm not, I don't, I, you know, Best Buy does not need a broad ruling from this court. I think the court could rule narrowly that in this case, where the plaintiffs admitted they had no material evidence regarding Best Buy's behavior and its taxation, to the day that I took the deposition of the relators, to that day, they had no idea how Best Buy taxed installed appliances. I mean, this is not a real whistleblower case, Your Honor. It's not. It is not a case in which there was inside information from an employee of Best Buy that led to a fraud. It's quite the opposite. You had a competitor in the field that claims, although he couldn't fully remember during his deposition, that he was just told, secondhand from customers that that may be the case at Best Buy, and that he might have looked at the website. Those are all public informations, right? Those are all things that don't qualify as whistleblowers. So, to the extent that this court, would want to help a relator in a situation like this, this isn't the case to do it. I mean, they affirmatively misrepresented that they had done exactly what they didn't. And under the Lujan factors, that weighs in favor of affirming the circuit court's dismissal of the case.
Thank you, counsel. I appreciate it. Thank you, Justice House.
Thank you. Thank you. Justice Van Tine, do you have any questions?
Yes, you talked about how the Lindblom's didn't file its amended complaint, adding Best Buy as a defendant under seal. What really is the significance of that if the government knew all along that they were auditing Best Buy, they were looking at the tax practices? Like, how does that hurt the government or the public or your client?
Your Honor, I think that ties back to the fact that this isn't a real whistleblower case. I mean, the government was aware of what was going on with Best Buy's tax treatment of installed appliances going back to 2009. There's admissions in the record about that. Again, in 2014, the information was disclosed and reviewed, and Best Buy passed those audits. As this court held in the Lowe's case, the audits were prima facie proof of the proper amount of taxes paid. So, I mean, we don't even have to get to the procedural issues and the pre-filing procedural issues just on that fact alone. I think that's significant. But in the context of the pre-filing procedures, the attorney general is the one that has to be notified of the fraud claims, which then in turn would go and do an investigation. And it's the Department of Revenue that has the information, right? And so the disclosure is to help the attorney general understand what the claims are, so we can then go and see, do we think that there's already an investigation underway that is taking care of this issue, right? The Department of Revenue is set up to do just this, to review these types of claims, make a determination of the propriety of the tax treatment, and then issue penalties or try to recover money if it thinks it was wrong. That's exactly what happened here. And had they followed the rules, the department or the AG's office would have gone to the Department of Revenue and asked, what's going on with Best Buy? And the response would have been, we already audited this issue and we found that they acted in good faith. They made a mistake, but they acted in good faith. I mean, that's exactly what all the testimony in this case reveals, is that while there was a mistake made post compliance alert, they decided that there was no penalties, there was no fraud, there was no ill will, there was no intent to deceive. And so with that, armed with that information, the attorney general would have dismissed this case outright, no doubt. It would have intervened and dismissed it. But it was robbed of that opportunity. And so here we are, having wasted all of the judicial resources that we have over the life of this case, which is approaching 10 years, when it should have never gotten off the ground.
So going back to the public disclosure bar, so the Department of Revenue knew about Best Buy's practice all along, but this plaintiff, Lindblom, claims he didn't. Is that right?
That's right.
So the purpose of the public disclosure bar isn't that for people like the Lindbloms who don't know about the practice because, I don't know, it's either it's to come forward if there's something that's askew about the way Best Buy is paying its taxes.
Right. Your Honor, the point of the Whistleblower Act, to the False Claims Act, is for insiders, people with real material information about a wrong, right, a fraud, to disclose it to the government so that the government can either choose to pursue the action itself or allow the relator to do it in a qui-tam suit. This case is different. And the reason why I say it's not a real whistleblower case is that the Lindbloms weren't insiders. They had no inside information. And in fact, all of the information, as you just said, was previously disclosed to the Department of Revenue. So this case should have never gotten off the ground. And when it comes to public disclosure, it's exactly what you just said, that the department of the government, the Department of Revenue, that's charged with reviewing this, was well aware of Best Buy's tax practices and affirmed them in the audits. And then when it changed its opinion about how these products should be taxed when installed, it reviewed it again long before the relators sued, months, over a year before they sued. It's stale information at best, but when I testified them, or when I examined them in deposition, they admitted at the day of, back in 2020, that they still had no idea how Best Buy tax its products. I mean, their case is fundamentally flawed in that respect.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay. Ms. McCutcheon, this case came on to us as a appeal from summary judgment. And generally, when we review these cases for summary judgment, we do a de novo review. Are you advocating that review the judge's finding on the legal issues under the abuse of discretion standard?
Your Honor, the only issue that needs to, that should be reviewed under abuse of discretion is that related to the pre-suit procedures under IFCA, because that the judge ruled was a sanction, and he ordered as a sanction dismissal of the case. And so the legal issues that go behind it, a whether a complaint or an amended complaint, should count for filing under seal, that is a question to review de novo. But the question of whether the trial court Judge Curry got it right in his sanction is reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard. Plaintiffs concede that in their own briefs. That's the mandate from the Illinois courts, and that's the mandate from the Supreme Court of the United States as well.
Thank you. Justice Ellis, Justice Van Tine, any further questions?
Just a brief follow-up. So you would analogize this to the denial of leave to amend? It's a sanction. It's just completely within the discretion of the trial court.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And what's the case you cite for that?
Well, the discretion is under the no reasonable person standard. I can give it to you here in a second.
Was part of the same order granting summary judgment?
Yeah, the court raised it as a sanction, but there's a case called Peterson v. Rahava, Red Hava, and it's at 313 Illinois App, third, number one, and it was decided in 2000. That's not a controversial point. I mean, the idea that a court would issue a sanction and dismiss a case and have it reviewed under an abuse of discretion has been long been the law in Illinois. And I would encourage you to go back and read Judge Curry's well-reasoned opinion on this. I've been an appellate lawyer now for 24 years, and I've been practicing in Cook County for just as long, and I've never seen an opinion quite like this one, and that from beginning to end covers all the bases and is as thorough as they come.
All right, any other questions?
Not
All
for
right.
me, thanks, Justice
Okay.
House.
All right, Mr. Burks, you may take a little time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let's see if I can limit myself to a few points on rebuttal. Starting on the scienter issue, I just want to point out that opposing counsel said that they paid under protest after they were audited and assessed and then litigated. That was for the audit covered the 2012 to essentially an 18-month period from mid-2012 through 2013. From 2013 all the way through to 2020, they did not pay the ROT. They did not charge it. They did not collect it. They did not pay it. For the full period of time that they were litigating the case, they were continuing with the competitive advantage over the independents. They were continuing with the parity with their multi-state competitors. Mr. McCutcheon indicates that because this was a gray area of the law, they should be given sort of a thumb on the scale. They got it wrong. Anybody could have gotten it wrong. I think that we should be that whether this was a gray area of the law should be presented to a fact finder, because EEP says there's no case law out there, but that's because the regulation was very clear. The statute was clear. No reasonable taxpayer who sells appliances would believe that they were a construction contractor based on this regulation. So I think he can present that there were some stray PLRs that Best Buy wants to interpret as supporting them, which we think that these GILs, which expressly are not the position of the department, do not state the law, but rather direct the taxpayers to look at the actual regulations, are not sufficient to get them over the hump. So we would like to present that as well as questions about their motivation. They say they re-examine the law post-compliance alert. I cited to you places in the record where we can see they're not examining the law, but rather checking with their competitors and reaching a conclusion based on the competitive consequences. That's a dispute of fact about what they did post-compliance alert and what their motivation was. So I think for the post-compliance alert period, we have disputes of fact, and we know it's undisputed that they did not collect. They did not charge. They did not follow the compliance alert, just like Lowe's. As to the three-factor test, the question of law is whether or not with respect to the pre-filing procedures, the question of law is whether the Lindblums were required to do the pre-filing procedures for the amended complaint. That's a question of law. The vast majority of cases, and I think the briefing shows this, hold that they were not. Even when a new defendant is added, as long as the legal theory is the same, as long as you're not bringing new claims, a new count that has different facts related to it, that you do not have to follow the pre-filing procedures because the government has already seen it. If the court were to find that the exception applies here, that the same claim against Best Buy was so different because we named Best Buy that the government needed notice once again, then the three-factor test applies. And if the court had applied the three-factor test, which is harm to the government, severity of the violations, and bad faith by the filer, then its application of that test would have been reviewed for an abuse of discretion. But if it failed to apply the test, if, as Judge Curry said, quote unquote, the law of this state must be enforced, and applied it as a black letter rule, then no, it's not an abuse of discretion. The failure to exercise discretion is an abuse of discretion. He did not apply the proper test. And then third, if he had applied the proper test, it clearly weighs in favor of the Lindblums here. Dismissal was an excessive punishment for failing to comply with the pre-filing procedures for an amended complaint, which repeated all of the same allegations in the original complaint, but added only a single defendant. That was not done in bad faith. We served the government with every one of our filings. That was clearly not bad faith. We weren't hiding anything from the government. Mr. McCutcheon's theory that the left hand of the AG's office didn't have the phone number of the right hand of the Department of Revenue, so they couldn't have found out that Best Buy was under audit, it just doesn't hold water. The Illinois Attorney General, the government, could have intervened at any time, could have dismissed this case out of hand. They could have done all of that, and they were fully aware of everything. So there was no bad faith. There was no harm to the government. To suggest that dismissal was the appropriate remedy for what was arguably, it wasn't even a violation, but if you were to find it was a violation, it would have been an abuse of discretion. As to the public disclosure bar, this is a plain language argument. Honestly, the word public means public. Mr. McCutcheon argues, well, the word public could mean confidential plus investigation. But the word public doesn't mean confidential plus investigation. You have to look at the plain language of the statute. You have to start there. And this court has repeatedly said that a disclosure must be public to be a public disclosure. It has said that public means the plain meaning of the word public. It has described what the plain meaning of public is, which is to the world at large, open. And that is Illinois law. That's not Seventh Circuit law. That is all in the Target case, in the prior Best Buy case, the case this is the second appeal of, and in the Trammell case from the second district. Those are the plain language arguments, and the policy arguments support the plain language in the sense that the government has a lot of information. Sometimes the government might be in cahoots. Sometimes the government might be negligent. It might not be looking at the information that it should be looking at. It might not have the resources or think that it's worth its time to do it. But if there's a false claim out there and an individual finds out about it, then if it's not public, then they're allowed to bring a claim on it. And this was not public. The idea that because it's an audit, there's a different rule that applies, but there are many, many public audits. I think we, in our brief, we cited the Auditor General's website, which lists public audits. The fact that tax audits are confidential just means that tax audits are not public disclosures. Audits, it doesn't nullify the statute. Many audits are public. Tax audits are not, so they cannot be public disclosures. And I think this leads me into this sort of maybe larger issue that's not really presented by this appeal, but Mr. McCutcheon's view that the relators are not really relators because they're not insiders, and that the case is not really a whistleblower case. That is a legal issue that Best Buy and the other defendants have lost multiple times, because you don't have to be an insider to be a qui tam plaintiff. You can do an investigation of public information and find information and tell the government about it. And you can and the Illinois False Claims Act allows you, permits you, and encourages you to bring such a claim. The leading case on this is Lemire's, which is a Seventh Circuit case. And it involved a competitor who watched his competitor operating and concluded that competitor was doing something that was against the law and filing false claims, and brought a False Claims Act case. And the Seventh Circuit in the Lemire's case, many years ago, explained that a whistleblower doesn't need to be an insider. And as to Mr. McCutcheon's, kind of repeated assertion that the Lindblums didn't know anything about how Best Buy was taxing, the Lindblums knew that Best Buy was selling dishwashers and selling microwave ovens and selling them with installation and not charging ROT. That is what they knew. They knew that from their customers. They knew that from competing. They knew that because they had to cut their prices to try to compete. They knew that because they shopped on their website. They knew that information. They disclosed it to the Department of Revenue, and the Department of Revenue audited Best Buy because of that. So clearly,
You
the
kind of wrap it
Lindblums.
up, please.
Sorry. So the Lindblums, obviously, the record shows, the proof is in the pudding. The Lindblums had information that the Department of Revenue thought was useful because they took it and they went and audited Best Buy. Thank you, Your Honor.
Right. Thank you very much. The case was well briefed, well argued. We enjoyed the presentation. We'll take this case under advisement and issue a decision in due course. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank
Thank you.
you.